Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Monday, August 3rd, and we'll be bringing you the Boston Globe to you with Grant Baxter just in a few moments. But for now, here's this Boston Globe story.
Thank you, Bill Walker. Hello, everyone. Let's start with a front page article in the Boston Globe today on August 3rd. Ballot questions remain unsettled. Lawmakers still talking on bills taking aim at tax refunds, public records. Article by Chris Van Buskirk. The halls of the State House might fall largely silent in the coming months, but negotiations will continue in private over measures that could affect a variety of issues, including several that could upend ballot questions before voters in November. Several prominent initiative petitions have already been struck from the ballot by the state's highest court for legal reasons. And Massachusetts lawmakers are weighing language that could blunt the effects of two others, one involving the size and frequency of refunds from surplus tax collections, and the second to subject the governor's office and legislature to the state's public records law. On Beacon Hill Friday night, legislators ended their traditional stretch of formal sessions, leaving a raft of work to closed-door negotiations where House and Senate leaders will try to resolve differences between bills their members had separately passed in earlier sessions. Legislators can strike deals on these policies at any point through early January under an internal rules change they approved last year. Evan Horowitz, executive director of the Tufts Center for State Policy Analysis, said lawmakers historically had two opportunities to address ballot questions in an election year, in the spring before the Secretary of State cleared them for the ballot and should pass muster with voters after Election Day. It's really complicated for voters if you can't even measure the potential impact of the ballot question by reading the text of the ballot question because it's going to interact differently with changing laws, he said. This is a very strange setup, and as complicated as ballot questions are already for voters, I think this adds to that. The push to preemptively change the public records and so-called tax cap law has stirred frustration on and around Beacon Hill. Transparency advocates raised alarms after the House and Senate passed different versions of a bill that sets their own rules for access to legislative and gubernatorial records. House lawmakers in July approved legislation that exempts the legislature from the state's public records law and instead creates a new statute that allows for access to specific types of legislative records, many of which are already public. The bill would also subject Governor Maura Healey's office to the existing records law, from which she and her predecessors for decades have argued they're exempt. Senators also carved out a specific set of documents and information that would allow access to those of the records, too, are already largely public. During debate in the Senate on Thursday, State Senator Cindy Green said the Senate's bill strikes a balance between transparency and lawmakers' concerns that subjecting themselves to the law as it is could violate the constitutionally set separation of powers. State Senator Diana DeSoglio, who is helping lead the push behind the public records ballot question, questioned the language the Senate embraced, making its bill the sole and exclusive remedy for obtaining legislative records, is itself unconstitutional. These types of games have no place in our state government, said DeSoglio, a former senator herself. What the legislature is doing is preemptively striking out against their own constituents to block the results of the election. State Senator Bruce Tarr, the top Republican in the chamber, publicly questioned how the Senate's bill would impact the ballot question. Green did not have a direct answer for him during the debate. And Grant, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate that. And moving on to the world pages, have this story. Israel says it's wary of Hamas disarmament deal. Claims foe plans to boost military, expand presence. Article by Sam Mednick of the Associated Press, Dateline Tel Aviv. Israel has shared serious security concerns with the White House regarding the proposed disarmament deal with Hamas, an Israeli official said, as Israeli strikes overnight and into Sunday evening killed at least 17 people, including children, in Gaza. The remarks by Doron Spielman, spokesperson for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office, were some of the first public comments since President Trump announced the agreement. Spielman told the Associated Press that Israel's intelligence assessment is that Hamas remains committed to rebuilding its military rather than genuinely demilitarizing. He said the Israeli military would not withdraw from Gaza, where it controls more than 60% of the territory, before Hamas disarms. Our assessment is that if we redeploy before Hamas is truly disarmed, it will quickly expand its presence throughout Gaza, rebuild its terrorist infrastructure, once again threaten Israeli communities, and seek to carry out another October 7th style attack, he said. This referring to the Hamas militant attack on Israel in 2023 that triggered the war in the Gaza Strip. Disarming means physically giving up the weapons, nothing less, Spielman said. His comments come days after Hamas said that it would begin disarming as part of the U.S.-brokered ceasefire signed 9 months ago to end the nearly three-year-long conflict. It marks a potential breakthrough in ending the conflict, but many hurdles, conditions, and long timelines remain. Trump's 20-point ceasefire plan calls on the militant group to surrender its weapons and destroy its vast network of tunnels. It also envisions Israeli forces withdrawing from Gaza, the arrival of a new technocratic Palestinian government, deployment of an international security force, and the rebuilding of the battered Palestinian enclave. Hamas disarming has been a sticking point and has deadlocked negotiations for months. In announcing the deal on social media Thursday, Trump said it would be carried out in carefully structured phases. A copy of the agreement obtained and verified by the AP said that all weapons held by the Hamas-run police will be transferred to the U.S.-backed Palestinian Technocratic Committee, known as the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza, this upon its arrival in the enclave. It's not clear when that would happen, since it is contingent on other steps. A process to decommission and store heavy weapons and to dismantle military production sites and tunnels will begin after the arrival of the Palestinian Committee and the deployment of international forces. The process will be linked to a phased Israeli withdrawal, this according to the agreement. The areas Israel controls in Gaza have been mostly destroyed and depopulated. Most of the territory's 2 million Palestinians are in the other part, where hundreds of thousands live in squalid tent camps and destroyed neighborhoods. Israel appears unlikely to pull back significant forces or make other concessions ahead of its October elections. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces a tough re-election battle with his far-right coalition partners urging him to keep up the pressure on Hamas and leave forces in Gaza, and opponents accusing him of failing to prevent the October 7th of 2023 attack. Hamas-led militants attacked Israeli communities then, killing around 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and taking 251 others hostage. Israel responded with a punishing military offensive that has killed more than 73,000 people, this according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The ministry maintains detailed records viewed as generally reliable by the United Nations agencies and international organizations. Also, from today's Globe and the World Pages, this story here under news analysis, Far right sets tone on Spain migrant crisis. Warns current situation stems from soft policy. It's an article written by Mark Landler of the New York Times. It's Dateline Paris. In its chaos, desperation, and sheer scale, the sudden surge last week of tens of thousands of migrants into a Spanish territory in North Africa recalled similar scenes 11 years ago along the coasts of Greece and Italy. It was that the 2015 crisis when more than 1 million people, mostly from the Middle East, swept into southern Europe that deepened opposition to immigration across Europe and emboldened the far right. Now, as then, far-right leaders have tried to exploit scenes of border chaos on the doorstep of Europe. In Britain, France, and Italy, anti-immigrant politicians warned that the latest crisis was stark proof of the dangers of Spain's immigration policies, which are more liberal than those of many of its European neighbors. The difference is that these far-right parties, largely marginalized in 2015, are now either in power or have a plausible path to it. In Europe's centrist leaders, desperate to avoid a political backlash, have adopted some of their hardline policies and language on immigration, abandoning the more welcoming approach of 2015. In little more than a decade, the far right has largely reshaped the immigration narrative. If centrist leaders give the impression that they are being outflanked on these issues, they will lose the narrative completely, said Francois Germain, a specialist on migration and climate issues at HEC Paris, a business school. That's why they feel obliged to show themselves as very tough on issues like border control. Centrist leaders from Denmark to France quickly condemned the influx to Ceuta, the Spanish territory whose borders were overwhelmed Thursday. They vowed to fortify their own frontiers to block the migrants, even though most of the new arrivals had turned around and crossed back into Morocco. Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen of Denmark, a social democrat who has enacted one of Europe's strictest asylum policies, called on her fellow leaders to consider suspending Spain from the Schengen area, which allows free movement among 29 countries in Europe. There was little to differentiate her reaction from that of Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni of Italy, a right-wing leader who came to power promising to curb immigration. Meloni said the images from Ceuta were striking and demonstrate once again that uncontrolled illegal immigration poses a concrete threat. Italy, she added on social media, will not stand by and watch. Chancellor Friedrich Merz of Germany demanded that Morocco take back illegal migrants immediately. It was a long way from Angela Merkel, Germany's last center-right chancellor. She famously said, "We're schaffen das, we can do this," when confronted with a wave of refugees from war-torn Syria in 2015, many of whom are now European citizens. These responses attest to the general hardening of Europe's immigration policies, a trend that has made Spain's current left-wing government an outlier. Countries like Sweden, once viewed as generous in creating routes to citizenship, have passed stricter rules on granting asylum and legal residency. More aggressive measures at sea have seen maritime migration levels plummet, since 2015. Analysts said the tough tone from leaders last week reflected a recognition that even if Europe is far from seeing a repeat of the 2015 crisis, public opinion can still be easily swayed by dramatic images, whether of rickety boats landing on English beaches or young men scaling chain-link fences to enter Spanish territory. It's the visible lack of control that's the problem, said Sundar Katwala, director of British Future, a London institute that focuses on integration and identity. That will recreate the, resonate with the core audience of the populist parties. The story, as we continue in the world section here, how China keeps tabs on citizens and foreigners. Police dashboard collects private data on vast scale. Article by two writers from the New York Times, Lily Kuo and Peilin Wu. Most days, Mark Hofer, a cybersecurity researcher and journalist based in Amsterdam, trawls the internet for clues about how China surveils its citizens, a subject that has fascinated him since he worked there as a foreign correspondent. Hofer, 46, was doing his usual scan earlier this year when he came across something called Dynamic Control Platform for Overseas Personnel. It was a futuristic dashboard, like something from the movie Minority Report, that appeared to track foreigners in the northern Chinese city of Zhangjiakou, a popular skiing spot that co-hosted the 2022 Winter Olympics. The system's dashboard said it tracked more than 700 foreign residents living in the city. In total, it had entries for nearly 12,000 people, which included fugitives, people from Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as more than 300 foreign journalists. Some of them had not been to Zhangjiakou. Suddenly, Hofer saw his own face in a photograph taken by Chinese immigration officials for their records. Next to it was his passport number and the cell phone number he had used in China. He was floored. Whoever put that stuff in there had access to real data, he recalled. He also noticed a list of users who had recently logged into the site. It included the names of police stations in Zhangjiakou and other cities. China monitors its 1.4 billion people on an unparalleled scale with the help of cameras, cell phone signals, and national IDs. The database Hofer found offered a rare window into how extensively Chinese authorities also surveil foreigners, displaying entries about people categorized by nationality with their birth, date, sex, marital status, address, and occupation, and sometimes their religion. That day in January, he began downloading as much data as possible from the site. By May, it had been taken offline. The New York Times found links between the platform and Origin Dynamic, a Beijing company that provides robotics, surveillance services, and equipment to police, according to public tender documents. Origin Dynamic had filed a patent application in 2023 for a similar system, which it described as an information interface for non-Chinese citizens. It was nearly identical to the Zhangjiakou platform in its design and functions. The company is owned in part by the city government of Yangshan in Jiangsu province. Origin Dynamic and the Zhang Qiku Public Safety Bureau did not respond to requests for comment sent by email and fax. Hofer, who shared the data he saved with the Times, believed that the dashboard had been designed for Zhang Qiku Public Safety Bureau, the city's police department. It included information that only Chinese authorities would have had access to, and the user log that Hofer saw listed 8 police stations in Zhang Qiku and 3 from other cities. It was not clear how or if police have used the database in their work, but its existence illustrates how Chinese authorities aggregate vast amounts of data from surveillance cameras, medical records, bills, facial recognition tools, and other sources to monitor and analyze the behavior of foreign residents. Shifting now, we turn to the nation's pages for these stories. First, how Trump's deal with Paul Weiss reshaped big law, foreshadowed how firms would yield to pressure. Article by Michael Schmidt and Jessica Silver Greenberg of the New York Times. When law firm Paul Weiss reached a deal with the White House last year to resolve an executive order that threatened it with crippling sanctions, the legal and political worlds were stunned. The firm had long been known for standing up to the government and championing progressive causes going back to the civil rights movement. But during the first Trump administration, Brad Karp, then chair, had fought the president in court on issues like separating migrant children from their parents. Partners at the firm had hosted a fundraiser for President Joe Biden and helped Vice President Kamala Harris with her debate prep. So when Karp quickly surrendered to the White House and made a deal to resolve an executive order widely seen as illegal, it seemed like a dramatic pivot. It was also consequential, foreshadowing how an array of institutions would bend to President Trump. Though 4 firms fought similar executive orders, 8 others followed Paul Weiss's example and cut deals, agreeing to perform a total of nearly $1 billion in free legal work for causes Trump supported. The New York Times spent months trying to understand what had happened within the storied institution, conducting interviews, reviewing court records, and obtaining internal emails and other documents. Here are 5 takeaways from the Times investigation. The surrender was years in the making and partly driven by profits. Long before the executive order, a struggle within the firm, Paul Weiss, pitted its stable of elite litigators against a rising crop of corporate lawyers singularly focused on the bottom line. As the corporate lawyers rode a wave of private equity growth and raked in more and more profits, their influence grew. They pushed against the pro bono civil rights litigation that had been at the center of the firm's culture. So when Trump took aim at Paul Weiss, partly because of its activist history, a long simmering identity crisis morphed into an existential one. The shift from idealism to money accelerated within a bold new hire. Looking to amp up Paul Weiss's corporate practice, Karp made what would turn out to be a fateful decision. In 2016, he hired Scott Barchet, a bona fide rainmaker from a rival firm who had a dizzying record of generating lucrative legal work. Barchet helped the rich firm become even richer, but that came at a cost. Behind the scenes, he was at times abrasive and led the effort to clamp down on social justice litigation, arguing it was bad for business because it could alienate clients. Also, the firm's treatment of a transgender lawyer showed how much it had changed. Bache took aim at a rising star, Lex Korberg, Paul Weiss's first openly transgender partner. Korberg, he uses they, them pronouns, decided to leave Paul Weiss after Bache pushed against their social justice work. What Korberg didn't know was that Bache had privately told other firm leaders that after they transitioned in 2021, he no longer wanted them dealing with his clients, arguing that a transgender lawyer could hurt business by making people uncomfortable. To insulate the firm, Paul Weiss struck a secret $3.5 million deal in 2023, never previously revealed, under which Korberg agreed not to sue or disparage the firm. Top leaders supported the Trump deal. Among the leadership of Paul Weiss, there was broad support to resolve the executive order. Even Karen Dunn, a top partner who had helped the Harris campaign, pushed to finalize the deal. "Let's get this done," Dunn wrote to Karp and other leaders in an email reviewed by the Times. Karp presented the framework of the deal at a March meeting of the firm's partners. He said that Paul Weiss would perform $40 million to free legal work for causes that both Trump and the firm championed. And final point in the article here, the deal undermined the firm's independence. In the days after the deal, in the storm of public criticism, as the storm of public criticism grew, Dunn pushed top leaders to bring a case against the administration that would telegraph Paul Weiss's continued independence. She had been searching for a potential client, including speaking with an abortion rights group about a lawsuit. But Bache and Karp objected, unwilling to risk invoking Trump's rage again. Paul Weiss never brought the case. The firm looked to appease the Trump administration in other ways, too. Also, we see this article here in the nation's pages. The GOP seeks to shift Kansas justices to the right. It's an article written by John Hanna. The battle over the Supreme Court reaches voters. It's Dateline Topeka, Kansas. Kansas voters will decide Thursday whether to elect state Supreme Court justices rather than have the governor appoint them, a push from conservatives who have chafed for years over court decisions they disagreed with on issues such as abortion, school funding, and the death penalty. If the constitutional amendment passes, supporters hope to elect at least 4 conservative anti-abortion justices to the 7-member court by 2033. Kansas is considering the change amid concerns that increasingly contentious and expensive judicial elections in other states are making their courts more partisan and less independent. Spending in a single state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin last year topped $100 million. Kansas Governor Laura Kelly, a term-limited Democrat who opposes the measure, said gerrymandering and dark money have put the legislature out of step with the state And to think you can make the judicial branch a part of that dysfunctional system is frightening. GOP lawmakers cite multiple rulings by Kansas courts over the past two decades as reasons for change. Most recently, a district court judge last month reinstated a three-day grace period for voters to return mail ballots after Election Day, which GOP lawmakers had eliminated. Kansas Senate President Ty Masterson, seeking the Republican nomination for governor, called the decision outrageous and urged people to vote yes on the ballot question. The same judge, a finalist to fill the most recent Supreme Court vacancy, blocked enforcement of a 2025 law banning gender-affirming care for transgender minors. Masterson described him as radical. The list of rulings Republicans criticize also includes rulings on education funding back to 2004. Supreme Court decisions forced lawmakers to increase funding in to comply with the state constitution. If we elect our Supreme Court, they won't force you to spend money on schools, Masterson said in remarks in November to a conservative group, the Marion County Patriots for Liberty. The Marion County Record reported of that story. Electing state Supreme Court justices gained currency among Republicans after a 2022 public vote affirming the High Court's landmark 2019 decision that Kansas Bill of Rights guarantees bodily autonomy and access to abortion. Total spending by both sides in that vote exceeded $12 million. Legislators who worked to overturn the Supreme Court's protection, including Masterson, helped write this year's proposal. 7 weeks after that 2022 vote, Attorney General Kris Kobach, then a GOP candidate for the office, told a Republican club in Wichita that electing justices would slowly and quietly put anti-abortion justices on the high court. The Vote Yes campaign's biggest donor, providing $1.7 million toward the campaign, $3.7 million in spending, is a Nashville-based nonprofit that supports Republican candidates, groups, and causes. Kansas for Life, the state's most influential anti-abortion group, has spent at least $87,000 over the past 11 days on mailers and texts. Kansans can bring an end to the reign of abortion by voting yes, Troy Newman, president of Operation Rescue, said in an editorial written by a staffer on the anti-abortion group's website. Meanwhile, the national and state affiliates for abortion provider Planned Parenthood contributed another $1.6 million toward the Vote No campaign's $8 million-plus in spending. Jamie Swan, an engineer and college teaching assistant who knocked on doors for abortion rights in 2022, is doing the same to try to halt the proposal. "I believe that this is just a power grab," she said. Backers of the Kansas proposal brush aside arguments that electing the justices will give wealthy donors control over the Supreme Court in the state. Also from today's Globe, in the daily briefing section of the nation's pages, this story: Washington fires burn 600 structures. About 5,000 homes have been evacuated and about 600 businesses, homes, and other buildings have been destroyed by wildfires that remained uncontained Sunday in eastern Washington, authorities have said. Fires burned more than 8.2 square miles around Spokane, the second largest city in Washington, and were among dozens across western United States, stretching the ability of federal, state, and local agencies to fight them. No deaths have yet been reported from the fires in the Spokane area. Meanwhile, crews using bulldozers and helicopters continued for the 10th day to fight a fire that has burned nearly 525 square miles of grassland in western Idaho and eastern Oregon. The area is home to cattle ranches, and authorities said the fire is threatening more than 600 homes and 800 other structures. The weather in the area was expected to remain sunny and dry well into the week, with temperatures rising to more than 90 degrees on Wednesday. Officials say the fire was caused by lightning. The National Weather Service issued warnings about the air quality in eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, western and central Idaho, and western Montana. It issued red flag fire warnings for parts of Utah and Montana and western Nebraska, and extreme heat warnings for the southern parts of Arizona, California, and Nevada, in northern Montana. While the high temperature Sunday in Spokane was forecast to remain below 80 degrees and wind gusts from 35 miles per hour to 45 miles per hour were expected later in the day, so said Benjamin Cassell, public information officer for the federal response team from California, called in Saturday night to deal with the Spokane area fires. "We have weather working against us, and we have terrain working against us," Cosell said. Also, from today's Boston Globe, we look at these stories next. This from the daily briefing section of the World Attack in Pakistan Fuels Fear of Terrorism Surge. This is Dateline Islamabad. At least 14 people were killed in a suicide bombing outside a police station in northwestern Pakistan on Sunday evening, officials said. The worst attack in a surge of militant violence that has reignited fears in a region once dominated by Pakistani Taliban. The attack took place in the Swat Valley in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwan province as residents and civil society activists gathered near the police station for a peace rally to protest the recent rise in attacks. Pakistan's Interior Minister, Mohsin Naqvi, said police officers had sacrificed their lives to stop the suicide bomber from entering the police station, averting a much higher casualty toll. Bilal Fasia, a spokesperson for the Provincial Emergency Service, said that at least 14 people have been declared dead at two hospitals in the district. He did not specify how many were police officers and how many were civilians. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. Also, this story from Europe. Ukraine drones kill five in Russia. E-commerce warehouse set ablaze in attack. This is from the Associated Press. Ukrainian drone strikes killed at least five people across Russia, also hitting industrial sites in a further warehouse belonging to Russia's e-commerce giant Wildberries, local officials said. Wildberries, Russia's largest online marketplace, is sometimes described as Russia's answer to Amazon. In under 2 weeks, Ukraine has struck more than a dozen of the retailers' depots, part of Kyiv's aerial campaign aimed at undermining Moscow's war effort, hurting its economy and making people feel the consequences of the Kremlin's all-out invasion of Ukraine. Russian air defense overnight shot down 635 Ukrainian drones, including over occupied Crimea and the Black and Azov Seas. This according to the defense ministry in Moscow. The ministry did not say how many were launched or actually struck targets. Meanwhile, Russia attacked Ukraine with 133 drones during the night, 24 of which hit targets, according to the Ukrainian Air Force. Later Sunday, separate Russian attacks on the Ukrainian cities of Zaporizhia and Kharkiv killed at least two people, this according to local officials. Ukrainian drones targeted a Wildberries warehouse in the Samara region, some 500 miles from the Russian-Ukrainian border, this according to local governor Vyacheslav Fedoroshev. He said a fire had broken out, but there was no casualties. Kyiv's campaign against Wildberries first hit the company sites in Alexstrostol, just east of Moscow, and in the Tambov region on July 18th. Strikes followed on facilities across western and southern Russia, as well as Russian-held Crimea. At least nine people have been killed and scores wounded. Two people were killed as a Ukrainian drone struck a residential building in Saratov region east of Samara, a local governor, Roman Busrigan, said. He added that the strikes damaged civil infrastructure in Engels, where the deaths took place, in the regional capital of Saratov. Also tied to that conflict, Moscow bombing called terrorist act. Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyan on Sunday called a bomb attack on a restaurant in the capital the day before a brutal terrorist act, without saying who was responsible. The blast on Saturday evening at the Balzi Rossi, an upscale Italian establishment in central Moscow, killed three people, including the woman bomber, Russian state media said, citing local officials. Yesterday, a brutal terrorist act was committed in Moscow that claimed human lives. The victims are currently in the city's hospitals, where they are receiving all necessary care, Sobyan wrote on social media. He added that a probe into the attack was underway. Those responsible for committing this crime will certainly be found and will face the punishment they deserve, he wrote. At least 21 people were wounded when the explosive device detonated at the restaurant on Kudryashenkaya Square, the National Anti-Terrorism Committee said late on Saturday. This according to Russian state news agency RIA Novosti. A woman attempted to smuggle the bomb into the establishment, but a security guard refused to let her in before the bomb exploded, reported RIA Novosti. The Moscow Investigative Committee said on Saturday evening the attack was still being investigated. As of early afternoon on Sunday, there was no further information from Russian authorities, and no one had publicly claimed responsibility, according to the news agency. The restaurant was closed for a private function on Saturday evening when the event took place. Footage released by Russian state media showed heavily armed law enforcement officers, several ambulances, and other emergency vehicles at the site. Earlier this year, Russia's Federal Security Service announced that authorities would tighten security around senior military and government officials after a series of assassination attempts in Russian cities that followed the Kremlin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine back in February of 2022. So far, Russian authorities have not drawn any connection between Saturday's blast and these earlier attacks on the war in Ukraine. Russia previously said Kyiv was behind a car bombing in Moscow last April that killed Lieutenant General Yaroslav Moshkalik, a deputy head of the main operational department in Russia's general staff. Ukraine did not publicly claim responsibility. But Ukraine's SBU security service earlier said it had organized the killing in December of 24 of Lieutenant General Igor Kirillov, that headed up the Russian military's nuclear, biological, and chemical protection forces. Kirillov was killed by a bomb hidden in a scooter outside his apartment building in Moscow, a day after Ukraine's security service leveled criminal charges against him. Among other prominent victims of bombing attacks in Russia were Daria Dugina, the daughter of influential national thinker Alek Dugin, and Vladlen Tikhatsky, a well-known pro-Kremlin military blogger. Kyiv denied involvement in the attack on Dugina and did not respond to Russian accusations that it was behind Tikhatsky's death. Well, this story. With big donations, U.S. renews health aid, promises $600 million to help countries get child vaccines. Article by Stephanie Nolan from the New York Times. Over the past 2 months, the United States has made financial commitments that hint at a limited return to global health and humanitarian assistance. The partnerships, after the abrupt severing of many of those relationships a year and a half ago. Last week, the State Department notified Congress that it would send $600 million to Gavi, an organization that helps low-income countries buy essential childhood immunization. This is a year after Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. withdrew U.S. support. It was the latest in a series of financial commitments from the U.S. government to international organizations working on issues such as hunger and tuberculosis, totaling nearly $2 billion. In most cases, these payments move money that have been appropriated by Congress, but that have been stuck since the Trump administration took office in January of 2025. And instituted a freeze on foreign aid. It is not yet clear whether the disbursements represented a lasting shift or how close any further commitments would bring the total to what the United States used to spend on aid in global health. People who have been part of talks with the State Department about the funding said there were at least two motivations behind the money flowing to resumed partnerships. First, recent health threats, including most notably the ballooning Ebola outbreak in the Congo, reinforced the need for funding multilateral agencies that work on global health security. Second, with the Trump administration's dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development and absorption of a skeleton crew of its staff into the State Department, there was no longer the infrastructure or staff of the United States to move humanitarian assistance on this scale by itself, making these larger international agencies necessary partners. What may be happening here is that reality is sinking in for decision makers, said Mark Green, who served as an administrator of USAID during President Trump's first term and who is president of ONE, an advocacy organization for foreign assistance. He added, I think there's a realization that global health security is also American national security, too. 18 months ago, the freezing of assistance was perceived internationally as a significant U.S. retreat from multilateralism. It created immediate financial crisis for many aid institutions, leaving gaping holes in budgets, such as that of the World Food Program, which provides emergency food aid in war and disaster zones. And it presented an existential crisis for humanitarian assistance in global health architecture that had long been predicated on bedrock U.S. support. Jeremy Levin, the top official for foreign aid at the State Department, said his team continues to be focused on remaking foreign assistance to be leaner and more efficient and to end recipients' dependence. These international organization relationships, we can use them tactically where they're important, but it doesn't mean we need to fund them year after year after year when they don't have that same nexus to something that we care about, he said. In addition to the money for Gavi, recent major funding announcements from the State Department include $800 million for the World Food Program to fight malnutrition in countries including Ethiopia, Myanmar, and Ukraine. Another $218 million for UNICEF to work on improving child health through nutrition, water, and sanitation projects. Add $100 million to Operation End Starvation, a new public-private partnership working to lower child mortality from malnutrition. Also, $50 million for the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, innovations for the development of new Ebola vaccines. $203 million for the International Committee of the Red Cross and International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies for disaster responses and humanitarian assistance. $220 million for the Ebola response in the Congo, and an additional $350 million in new humanitarian funding to the affected region. That is as of June 12th. And $661 million to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, a payment against what was owed from prior year appropriations. I'm hoping we're back to a regular order of payouts that are consistent with the Global Fund being an important partner, said Chris Collins, the president of Friends of the Global Fight, an advocacy group that lobbies for support of the Geneva-based health organization. Gavi Chief Executive Sonia Nishtar also expressed relief about the restoration of U.S. support this week. This new funding is vital, she said. It will help us maintain emergency vaccine stockpiles for Ebola and other deadly diseases and help countries turn the tide on malaria. Also briefly here, this polls don't register with Trump. Falling numbers unlikely to spur any changes. It's an article crafted by Peter Baker of the New York Times at Stateline, Washington. After a spate of bad polls earlier this summer, President Trump simply declared that they were not true. My real poll numbers are the highest they have ever been, he wrote on social media, using capital letters as if they would shout away any contrary data. In fact, his real poll numbers are at or near the lowest they have ever been in some nonpartisan surveys. A flurry of new samples in recent days found that Trump is at the nadir of his presidency, with support from just around one-third of Americans, as a stalemated war in Iran and high gas prices take a political toll. The latest surveys indicate that Trump is now all but the most unpopular second-term president at this stage of their tenure in the history of polling, going back to the 1940s. The only exception is not one that would give Trump much solace. Richard Nixon had even less public support at this stage in his second term, but at that point, he was just days away from resigning over the Watergate scandal. These kinds of poll numbers would throw a normal White House into panic mode, especially coming just 3 months before a midterm election. Someone might be fired, a speech might be written, a new set of policies might be devised. But Trump has never been a normal president, and he does not react to political circumstances in the same way his predecessors have. Through force of will and command over his MAGA base, he has traditionally played a weak hand strong. Briefly, and with the weather, forecasters say, heads up today, we could see heavy rain at times, showers, intermittent but heavy, throughout the day into the early evening. In some places, torrential downpours with flash flood warnings. So check your local area. Make certain you're in tune with that as the day moves through. Also, with the sports, oh my golly, the Boston Red Sox keep winning baseball games and closed out a three-game sweep of the Los Angeles Dodgers in L.A. yesterday. Final score in that ballgame, Sox 8, Dodgers 4. Sox have moved to 60-51 of the season, 9 games over .500. What will the future hold for them? We'll see. With that, thank you, as always, for your support of the Talking Information Center. Hopefully, we provide to you what you need as we move through the air, and we can continue to do so. So thank you, and we'll go from here. Enjoy your weeks. Take care.
Hello, once again, audio journal listeners. My name is Bill Ruggiero, giving you the latest sports schedule for Monday, August 3rd, 2026. Well, the Boston Red Sox will play the Chicago White Sox tomorrow night. That game begins at 7:10 p.m. 6:10 p.m., join all your pregame action with Christian Arcan and the Red Sox pregame show on 93.7 WEEI-FM in Boston. Then catch the game with Will Fleming and Will Middlebrooks on the call of the game between the Red Sox against the White Sox at Fenway Park in Boston. While the Worcester Red Sox will take on the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs tomorrow night, that game begins at 6:45 p.m., 6:25 p.m., join Alex Jensen and Mike Antonellis on the Woo Sox pregame show on 98.9 Nash Icon WORC-FM radio and 100FM The Pike WWFX radio. That is with Alex and Mike with the call of the game between the Worcester Red Sox and the Iron Pigs from Polar Park in Worcester, Massachusetts. Well, the Patriots will play their first exhibition game a week from Thursday. That's August 13th at 7:30 p.m. 4:30 p.m. Catch Dan Roach, Mark Bertrand, Steve D'Arcy, and Chris Gasper on 98.5 The Sports Hub, WBZ-FM in Boston. Then catch the game with Bob Soucy and Scott Zolak on the call of the game between the Patriots and the Indianapolis Colts at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Again, that is your latest sports schedule for today, Monday, August 3rd, 2026. This has been Bill Ruggiero saying have a good and happy day, everybody. And please stay tuned for more programming coming up next on Audio Journal. Take it easy, everybody. Have a great day. Bye.
Did you know ADA paratransit riders in Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northboro, Oxford, Westboro, and West Boylston now have the option to schedule trips through the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's new online reservation system? Call customer service at 508-791-9782 or email paratransit at theRTA.com to begin scheduling your trip online.